For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. After the presentation, the speaker will answer questions from the audience. Our speaker today is Lita Judge. I am especially honored to be here because I'm a lover of the novel Frankenstein, and I'm a teacher who's taught it at least 10 times. And I taught it to seniors in high school, and they were delighted and astounded to find that it wasn't a horror story. And they were most excited and some of them intimidated to find out that Mary Shelley wrote this when she was 19 and they were 18, so they were a bit intimidated. Her book, Mary's Monster, is an illustrated novel in verse, and it tells the stranger than fiction story of the pregnant teenage runaway Mary Godwin, who followed her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, in writing a work revealing the difficult role of intellectual females in the late 1700s and early 1800s. But the daughter surpassed the mother, and through her iconic monster brought forth the first mad scientist archetype and invented the industrial age science fiction novel, though this triumph was published anonymously. Mary's Monster was completed after more than 6 years of research and writing and has been highly acclaimed. It was nominated for the Carnegie and Kate Greenaway Medals, the UK's most prestigious children's book awards. In addition, our speaker today has published 26 nonfiction and fiction books, including 1,000 Tracings, 2007, Red Sled, 2011, Hoot and Peep, 2016, and Penguin Flies Home, 2019. Her many awards include being named an American Library Association Notable, a National Council of English Teachers Notable Book, a Kirkus Best Book, and Jane Addams Honor. Her work is now translated into 15 languages, and her book Flight School has been adapted into an off-Broadway musical currently playing in New York City, China, and other parts of the world. A resident of Peterborough, she travels extensively in America and abroad, visiting and speaking at schools. As we welcome Lita Judge, who will share how Mary Shelley created Frankenstein, I'd like to close my introduction by reading something that she uses in her book, and there are copies going to be available. And the line that I so like is this, and I think it will be a perfect opening for her talk today. In her book, Mary Shelley's voice says, "I know how hard it is to live life as large as a poem." So let us enthusiastically welcome our speaker today, Lita Judge.
Thank you. It's my honor to speak at the Lyceum. When Dave and I moved here 15 years ago, one of the very first things we fell in love with about this town was the Lyceum, and that was long before I was ever a writer. So it's an honor to be here and to be participating. And it's always a pleasure when you get to speak about your book in front of your hometown. I've traveled throughout America and also in Europe speaking about this book, so this is lovely to be here in Peterborough. This book originated in 2010. I reread the novel Frankenstein. I had read it as a ninth grader, on my own, not in the structure of a classroom. And I think I was too young for the text then. The themes of the book went way over my head. So when I read it again in 2010, I was completely unprepared for how deeply the book resonated with me. I had known that Mary Shelley wrote the book, so I knew the author was a woman, but I knew nothing about that author. I just assumed she was an older aristocrat who had written the book. I hadn't really given much thought about it. I had heard the origin legend that I think a lot of people, when I was working on the book, I kind of discovered that a lot of people, the only thing they knew about Mary Shelley is this origin legend, and that is Mary Shelley, along with her boyfriend Percy Shelley, were staying in the Villa D'Oyota, this stormy villa with the infamous Lord Byron, and that on a stormy night, Lord Byron had dared everybody to write a ghost story. And when I reread the book, I realized, but this isn't a ghost story. This incredible social criticism of its day, challenging that the mistreatment of those unlike ourselves and, you know, what the outcome to that is. And it's also challenging what might happen in a world where men use science for their own ambition with no regard to what that can set into motion. And so suddenly, this origin story no longer held any credence at all for me. And that baited the question, well, why did she write this? And more importantly, how was she able to write this? This is a book that has been in print for 200 years. It's one of the most read novels of all time. It set forth a revolution of literature, and it was written by this young teenager. You can, just by Googling, I realized right away she was a teenager when she wrote the book. And that actually baited more questions than answers, because how could a 19-year-old write a book with this lasting impact to the world? And so it really started this journey for me to discover, why did Mary Shelley write it? And more importantly, how was she able to write it? I'm fortunate in that Mary lived in a time when people wrote letters rather than email, and she was a consummate letter writer. And the Bodleian Library in Oxford houses all of her letters and diaries. She also kept a diary leading up and during the time of publishing this book. And so I was able to really step into her footsteps and read endless records of her life during this time. And so I had this wealth of information in order to build this book. When I was discovering these facts in the beginning, I had no intention of writing the book. It was merely a personal exercise for myself to answer these questions. I was happily creating fiction picture books at the time. But at the end, I became so outraged about the origin story, and that's what we know of Mary Shelley. This is a remarkable young woman, and the origin story places the credit of writing this book in the hands of a male author, that of Lord Byron. And she was forced to publish her book anonymously, and so in that act of being an anonymous author, we stripped down any knowledge that we have of her as well. And so it really was that outrage that in ninth grade, when I read her book, I had been deprived that knowledge that kind of propelled me to begin writing the book. I'm going to read just a couple of poems from the book because I feel like sometimes the poetry explains her life better than what I can in a short period of time. The first poem I'm going to read is Do Not Return. This is the first poem of the book. And it is when Mary herself is 14 years old, and she is being set out to live with a family she's never met in Scotland. She's being sent away from her own home. The book is Do Not Return, and its title date is June 7th, 1812. Early summer in a time of war, when the sea is a battleground and ships are weapons, I find myself on the deck of the Ossenburg, heading for Scotland. Little separates me from the mail and cargo in the ship's hold. I am like a letter stamped, do not return, being delivered to a future I cannot know. I try to keep the shorelight in sight as if this will prevent the wind driving the sails, but gradually the land recedes into a thin line and then is swallowed completely by bruise-colored clouds. I am left to feel completely alone. Frankenstein is a novel whose main theme centers around isolation and how cruelty and isolation together can drive a person to destroy their soul and they themselves become cruel. Mary is a young girl who totally understands cruelty and isolation because she lived it. She was born to Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin, and her life might have been very different had her mother lived, but unfortunately her mother died giving birth to her. Mary Wollstonecraft was a remarkable woman. She was an author, she was a journalist, she ran headlong to France to cover the French Revolution. She was this remarkable woman that set in motion feminism, the movement of feminism. She believed in the rights of women. Unfortunately, she died giving birth to Mary. Her father, William Godwin, he was an anarchist and a radical political thinker. He was also an author and a book publisher. And so he brought up his girls. He had Mary through Mary Wollstonecraft and also an older daughter, Fanny, who Mary Wollstonecraft had bore out of wedlock 2 years before Mary. And he brought up the girls to believe they should be free thinkers. He educated. They lived in a house where Coleridge would come to dinner. And so these girls were really brilliant, but it was actually a very tough existence because shortly after his wife's death, he married the neighbor, another Mary, who I'll call Mary Godwin because there's a lot of Marys in this book. But Mary Godwin was this foul-tempered woman who was notorious for slapping the girls and shouting at them, and she bickered with everybody. And it became a very tense family. Also, Byron was a terrible businessman, and so they were riddled in debt, and so it was incredibly stressful. And by the time that Mary was 14, Mrs. Godwin had convinced her father to send her away from home. She was this archetype stepmother. She favored her own children. She had two children, but she really mistreated Fanny and Mary. And Mary, I think, was the one that stood up to her, so Fanny stayed home and Mary was sent to Scotland. Her time in Scotland ended up being a beautiful time for her, though. The family that she lived with were the Baxters. They were Jacobites, and they had written Godwin saying how much they believed in his beliefs of anarchy, and they were revolutionists, and they had said, you know, if you ever need any help, please let us know. I think they knew Godwin was notorious for being riddled in debt, and I think they were offering funds, but instead he said, how about taking my daughter? So they take in Mary, but fortunately the family is very loving. They have children just slightly older than Mary that are very accepting of her. And she refers to this time in Scotland as her era of freedom. She was given freedom to run around on the cliffs of Scotland. She's happy, finally. She looks out over the cliffs to the whaling ships going off into Arctic waters. And so many of the letters that she writes during this time have descriptions that show up later in her novel, almost directly. So it's really interesting to see the parallels of this budding author really taking shape. And the most amazing thing about this period was that she really got to know her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft. The library was full of her mother's books, and she spent countless hours reading over her mother's books. And I'm going to read the poem, Mother, where she talks about her mother during this time. Mother. Mary Wollstonecraft was mother to a rebellion before she was mother to me. As a young woman, she left her home in England and braved mobs and bloody riots to run headlong to France and witness the birth of liberty in the midst of a revolution. Growing up in a time when there were no laws to prevent her father from beating his wife, she rose from a childhood of abuse and dared to be the first to denounce the unfair laws towards women with her book, A Vindication for the Rights of Women. She continued to devote her life to future generations of women by writing novels of fearless heroines. My mother challenged a world of angry men with a soft feather of her pen. Bayonets and cannons weren't her weapons of war. She chose words to begin her revolt. Her words were formed by courage. Her stories were her victories. So you really see Mary's growing awareness of not only her own brilliance, but a responsibility to continue her mother's work. Mary expressed often the burden she felt for having caused the death of her mother by her birth. And I think that she felt strongly that she inherited a legacy of continuing this work of feminism. And we see this time in Scotland as her opportunity to really understand that fully. Within 2 years, when Mary was 16, her father did eventually call her back to England, and by then she had no desire to go back. It was a terrible time for her to be heading back to Holborn, the town where the family, it's a part of London where her family was living. It was the beginning to the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and her father had been a huge advocate advocate for Napoleon. And so now with the end of that, he had really fallen out of favor. His political beliefs were completely vilified. Napoleon, instead of promising to end tyrannical rule, he had crowned himself emperor and sent armies across Europe. And Godwin had been such an outspoken advocate of this that it really set him up for his eventual failure. So the family was more tense than ever. Godwin had slipped into bankruptcy to the point of he was fearing debtor's prison. Also, returning to Holbein after the freedom of Scotland was horribly depressing. The family lived above the bookseller's shop where her father worked, and it was on Skinner Street, which gets its home from the fact that it was housed literally in the slaughterhouses of London. So Skinner Street, it gets its home from the fact that there's tanneries and the slaughterhouses all around. There's letters from inhabitants of this place that describe the horrific flies and the stench of blood and the screaming of the cows, the cattle during night. And again, we see directly the parallels that are going to eventually show in her novel. She was living through this existence. Also, two blocks away from their home was Holbein Prison, the largest prison in London. The gallows were notorious for Sunday entertainment in her neighborhood was witnessing hangings. Right after she got home, there was a horrible mob where people got crushed to death stampeding to witness these hangings. And even worse, there were these grisly experiments being performed within the prison walls on the cadavers of the hung prisoners, trying to study this new study of galvanism, which is where scientists were believing that electricity could be used to bring the dead back to life. And Mary attended lectures that discussed this. She was fascinated with the science of her time. So again, we see the budding author living the life that she will eventually read and breaking down this origin story. This is the girl that knew exactly what she was writing about because she was living through each one. Her time at Holbein was terrible. Her sister Fanny, her older sister that was born to the same mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, when they were little, they were very close. But when she came back from Scotland, Fanny had slipped into a pretty dark depression. When the girls were little, William Godwin had published a memoir of his wife, and he wanted to continue her work for feminism, but he believed in full honesty and truth, and he revealed that Mary Wollstonecraft had a married lover and got pregnant with Fanny and gave birth, and the lover left her, and she then tried to commit suicide. And that completely destroyed her reputation. It was 100 years before people returned to the writings of Mary Wollstonecraft. It also really destroyed Fanny, this knowledge that she was illegitimate and that she wasn't actually the daughter of the man that she thought she was her father. And this really set into motion a very difficult situation for Fanny because she's not only straddled with an incredibly terrible stepmother, but she's burdened with the fact that she's not actually her father's daughter. And seeing the outcome of what her birth had done to her mother in graphic detail in the memory really destroyed her happiness. So Mary is returned back. It's very, very tense. And within a few weeks of returning home, in walks Percy Shelley. He's 21. He's a baronet. He's handsome. He's a poet. He promises to give Godwin the money he needs to get out of debt. He sweeps Mary off her feet. He takes her for walks. They leave the streets of Holbein, and they talk of poetry and galvanism and alchemy, and he reads her his epic poem, Queen Mab, to her, which talks of building this utopian society. And, oh, by the way, I'm married. I have a wife named Harriet, but she never loved me. She only wanted me for my money. And he carries her Mary Wollstonecraft's novel in his pocket, Mary's mother's book, and he recites passages to her. And he goes after Mary with almost a predatory zeal. We know from letters that he was writing for his friends, and he went to that doorstep with all intentions of wooing the daughter of Mary Wollstonecraft. And that's exactly what he did. 6 weeks after they met, he takes her to the cemetery where her mother lays buried. And I'm always asked, this is usually the first question I get after a talk, is it true? Did he woo her by her mother's grave under the willow tree? And he did. They consummated their marriage, they consummated their relationship, and they vowed they would run away together to Switzerland where they would be part of building a utopian society where everybody could be treated equally. And Mary, I think the offer of freedom and the offer of a life where equality could be something that she could partake in, I think was so alluring to her that she goes along with this plan. Unfortunately, she gets home and tells her father that they're going to do this. She believes that he's going to say, do it. This continues our work. His most famous novel is Fleetwood, where a married man runs away with a 16-year-old girl and builds a utopia in Switzerland. He's raised her to, she knows that she's the illegitimate daughter of their, that they consummated her birth before they was married. She knows that he's proud to have married his second wife who had children born out of wedlock. So everything she has grown up to believe makes her think that this is going to be something he would be proud of. Instead, he locks her in her room and says, you know, I know certain terms that she had to run away with Shelley. So she's feeling incredibly distraught. Her younger sister, Claire, who's 15, had really gotten hopeful that perhaps she could take her when she runs away. So Claire is begging her to go. Fanny's begging her to stay. Mary doesn't know what to do. Shelley is watching the door, and when Godwin steps out, Shelley bursts in carrying a pistol, and he runs upstairs, and he promises to shoot himself if Mary won't run away. So inevitably, she decides finally to do this. She follows her heart. She runs away. In the middle of the night, she and Claire drift off to meet Shelley at a designated spot, and they take a boat across from Dover to Paris. When they get to Paris, Shelley says, oh, by the way, I don't have much money. My father's cut me off because I left my wife, Harriet. You know, she's feeling in love. She's feeling hopeful. Shelley convinces her this will be fine. This is, I'll read a passage of a poem that I wrote that's directly from a letter he wrote to a friend about this period of time. He says, we don't need money. We are poets, anarchists, prophets. Our pockets need only be filled with love for the universe. We will drink sour milk and eat stale bread. We will walk over mountains. And so he convinces these two young girls that they're going to walk from France to Switzerland. This is during a time right after the Napoleonic Wars. France has been riddled in war for two decades. It's just a series of burnt-out villages, massive battlegrounds, graves that go on forever. And they witness a horrible famine. They witness these children that are deformed from malnutrition. This is a terrible time to be walking across Paris. And I wrote this poem, Son of Earth, that describes their time when they're walking across France. Son of Earth, the little donkey Shelley brought to carry our trunks sinks to his knees, and we must drag him piteously until we can trade him for a mule. My feet grow blistered, my muscles burned under black silks and blazing sun as we walk nearly 30 miles each day. Shelley marches on as if hunger and heat and exhaustion can't touch him until he sprains his ankle. Then Claire and I have to carry the trunks filled with books while Shelley rides the mule. Life, Shelley calls out, is like living in a Wordsworth poem. I am Voyager, wandering lonely as a cloud, forever meant to live a solitary existence. Claire and I feel the weight of the trunks, are too tired to respond as Shelley shouts, I am son of earth, orphan to storm, flung out by society to wander over the world in search of the sublime. So Mary is quickly realizing that life with Shelley is not at all what she had hoped it would be. By the time they get to Switzerland, they're living in this rat-infested shack. They have barely enough money to buy bread. There's no heat. Shelley is talking endlessly about free love. He's starting to look at Claire the way he looked at Mary. Now he's talking about writing for Harriet so they can all live together. And she realizes his ties with Harriet are far from ending. And she's also coming to the horrible realization that she's pregnant. She's suffering terribly from the early effects of morning sickness. And Mary slips into a depression. She's fixated on death. She's dreaming about her sister dying. I think she's feeling incredibly responsible or horrible that she's left Fanny. She knows what she's left Fanny to. Claire and her have escaped, and Fanny is living in Holborn. I think also the idea that she was pregnant must have been absolutely terrifying. She's 16 years old. Her mother died giving birth to her, and she's completely alone. And I think that explains this fixation on all these dreams about death. In the end, it's just the fact that they have a lack of money that she convinces Shelley to give up on this plan of this utopian society, and they return to England. Unfortunately, they go back to England to find that they're completely vilified. It's in the papers that Shelley has run away with two unmarried girls. Her father refuses to let her come home. Claire is allowed to come home. Mrs. Godwin has no intention of cutting off her own daughter, but she won't let Mary through the threshold. Her father won't even deign to recognize her when he passes her on the street. He's written all of her friends saying, don't write her. He forbids her to see her sister. So Mary is cooped up in this horrible rental with very little heat and little food. Claire keeps going home because she doesn't like not having any food or heating, and so she's going back and home. She comes in occasionally. Shelley is also gone almost all of the time. He's racked up debts, and he's constantly having to run away from bailiffs who are hounding him for bills. And so the only time Mary actually sees Shelley is on Sunday afternoon when the bailiffs aren't at work. So most of the week, she is living completely isolated, feeling completely abandoned by society, and she's been rejected by her family and from everybody around her, by her friends. She is forced to stay indoors as her pregnancy starts to show. And you see this growing isolation that parallels with the novel Frankenstein. The only thing she has to hold on to is that Claire is passing secret letters between her and Fanny, so she still has this relationship with her sister in the form of letter, and the child that is growing in her womb. And 7 months after she's run away, Clara, the baby, is born, horribly premature. The baby lives for 10 days. And then, again, I'm going to read the poem because it describes what she was feeling when she's holding the baby and the baby dies. Tears. Tears do not come at first, only a silent sob that builds into a howl. Like a wounded animal, I scream and scream until exhaustion numbs my aching throat. Then the dreams come. I hold Clara's body by the fire until the flames revive her. Her soft blue eyes open. My baby is brought back to life in my tormented sleep. When I wake, I must live the nightmare of her death all over again. So that is an incredible, eerie parallel lifted straight out of her diary, where we see the birth of Frankenstein and we see where this young woman is going to eventually sculpt this novel. At this point in her isolation, when she loses the baby, she slips into almost a suicidal depression. Claire and Shelley's relationship is almost certainly a physical love affair at this point. She is feeling an internal hatred. She's feeling a hatred for the fact that she's feeling jealous towards Harriet, only she knows she has no right to feel jealous for Harriet. Fanny has been very hard on her in her letters, very unsympathetic to her plight. She's hating Claire. Claire really was her only family that she had left to her. And you see this growing hatred inside her, which I think is building this theme of how cruelty and isolation can actually literally destroy a soul. The only way I think that she eventually finds her way back, she's actually a pretty brilliant, perseverant young woman. And Shelley relies on her for her intellect. He's writing again. He begins writing again a poem called Alistair. And he really strongly relied on Mary's intellect, her editing, and she would write out his poems and she would make changes. A lot of people surmise after the publication of Mary of Frankenstein, once it was known that she wrote the book, a lot of people thought that Shelley had a really direct influence on her. But if you actually go through the rough drafts of their work, Mary exerted far more influence on Shelley's work than he did of her. He would get flowery and wax on too long, and she would reel in his poetry. And I think that Claire didn't have the intellect that Mary did. She was not interested in books, and I think that in the end, Shelley would keep returning to Mary because of what she had to offer him. Mary becomes pregnant again, too, which I think gives the couple new life. At 18, she gives birth to their son, William. And they've also inherited a small amount of money from the death of Shelley's godfather, and that takes away some of the pressure. Mary, for a brief time, convinces Shelley to send Claire away. And they soon decide that they're going to try once again to go to Scotland and live this utopian society that they had started off their relationship hoping for. One of the things is they had found life in England completely untenable. When Alistair, Shelley's poem, came out, it was so vilified by the critics. They didn't review the poem. They only reviewed his scandalous behavior. And they were just being constantly hounded by the press. Claire's life was really at loose ends, too, and I think Mary felt a responsibility to that. She was 15 when they ran away with her. Claire's reputation had been utterly destroyed. She was never going to get married either. She talked about going on the stage, but she had no talent. by then, her reputation was so destroyed that even her mother had cut her off as well. I think Mary allowed Claire back into their lives because I do think that Mary was an incredibly empathetic soul, and Claire just really had no options at this point. And then we get to the Villa de Yota. This is where they hook up with Lord Byron, this infamous poet who is incredibly famous at the time, but probably even more known for scandal and debauchery than Shelley. And it's this 1816, it was called the Year Without Summer, because the year before, there was a volcano in Indonesia that erupted, and it was one of the largest eruptions of all time, and it sent this ash cloud into the atmosphere, which blocked out the sun. And all over the world, crops were failing, and people were starving from famine. A foot of snow fell in Italy in the summer. Crops in New England, China, Europe were failing, and people were thinking it was the end of the world. And here's Shelley and Byron, who love science, and they're inside debating about the fact that it could be this volcano, and they're debating, you know, the meaning of life. And we get these fiery lightning storms, and we get the night of the daring of the ghost story. I do believe that there was a night when Byron dared everybody to write a ghost story. I just don't believe that's what resulted in Frankenstein. Nobody else wrote a ghost story, so I don't think that was Mary's prompt. Unfortunately, it becomes very obvious that Byron has this aristocratic sense of privilege, and he's really a despicable guy. Shelley has done horrible behavior, but I think we can be slightly empathetic to the fact that he probably was mentally ill. Byron was just cruel. He originally is a huge influence on Shelley, and they're debating art, and it quickly turns into he's sneering at him, he's scoffing at his beliefs. Shelley is convinced that galvanism can bring the dead back to life. Byron is sneering at him for his bourgeois notions, and there's this infamous night where their debate kind of spills over, and Shelley pounds down on the table and says, "Man, not God, could bring the dead back to life." And I'm going to read the poem because it explains kind of what Mary is not partaking in this diary or in this discussion. It's clear from her diaries that she was just a silent spectator, but inside she's thinking a lot about this issue. "What do men know of creating life? I am sickened they talk so easily of men, not women, creating life. It is men, not women, who march with armies across countries, pillaging and burning villages, leaving children to starve. Now men aim their ambitions on conquering nature. Shelley and Polidori are wrong to envision such things. Science gives us the ability to pull back the skin of life and reveal the truth of things. It allows us to understand the mysteries of mountain making and falling stars. But knowledge isn't meant to be held as a weapon in a battle to defy our fates and manipulate life over death. Evil lodges too easily in the hearts of men. What will happen if they assume the power to create life?" I should say Polidori is Lord Byron's servant, Dr. Polidori, who was infamous from that night as well. So Mary goes upstairs that night, and this is where the spark to beginning the writing of the novel occurs. She describes in her diary quite clearly about having a wakeful dream, and this is the poem I wrote to describe that event. "Heart pounding against ribs. Cold sweat drips down my spine as I am seized by a wakeful dream. I see a pale student of an unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he has put together, a hideous phantasm of a man with watery eyes and blackened lips, stirs with motion." Mary begins writing in earnest almost immediately, and for a few short weeks, it seems like maybe things are going to be okay for her. Shelley, actually, for all his flaws, really does believe in equality for women. He's a huge supporter of her writing. He encourages her. He believes that this book could be of merit. And everything seems like maybe this could turn around for the young couple until Claire comes crying to Mary, and she is pregnant by Lord Byron. And Byron has tossed them out of the villa. He will see Shelley, but he will not see Claire and Mary. They're forbidden to come through his door. And he's telling them in no uncertain terms, when that baby is born, he will take it and put it in a convent, and he will not let Claire have anything to do with it, the child. So Mary convinces Shelley that they have to go back to England. They've got to protect Claire and try to have Claire bring this baby up. Once they go back to England, her life just goes deeper into nightmares. Shelley is once again gone most of the time, and Mary becomes to realize that he's almost certainly with Harriet. and she is left to take care of their young child and a very pregnant and distraught Claire. And then a letter arrives from Fanny, and the letter is so distraught and depressed that Mary fears the worst, and she contacts Jelly, and they head off to go try to save Fanny and bring her back. And unfortunately, Fanny has already committed suicide by that point. And even worse, Godwin won't let her claim the body. So I wrote this poem to describe what this felt like for her. I will not be silenced. How easily Father discards the girl who he raised as his own child. He forces me to abandon Fanny to an unmarked grave. But I will not abandon her memory. The grief and guilt and anger and truth I feel about her death weave into the characters of my book. I keep writing as death continues to circle around me. Within a few weeks, Harriet's pregnant body is dredged from the river, and rumors are flying that her child is also Shelley's, and Mary's pretty sure that that rumor is probably true. We can't know for a fact, but a lot of evidence points to the fact that Shelley had resumed his relationship with Harriet. So Mary is feeling incredibly burdened by Harriet's death. She feels culpable to the point of being partly what drove Harriet to her death, and she feels a responsibility for that. She also feels a responsibility for Fanny's death because she had abandoned her when they ran away and left her to Skinner Street. And she has a growing sense of guilt over the fact that she has a child and she's now expecting another child, and those children are going to be labeled as illegitimate and bastards the way Fanny was. And she has a growing sense that her ideals that this will be okay versus the reality that it's not going to be okay, that her decisions have set forth in motion decisions that are going to affect everybody that she loves. But through all of this, she keeps writing, which I think is incredibly remarkable and a testament to her resilience. And this is a poem I wrote during this time when she's feeling all this guilt. Do you hear me? I keep writing until my pen scratches pain as loud as screams. But it is no longer my own voice I hear. It is the creature's. Ink black words on paper are no longer words. They breathe and pulse with a life of their own. They are heart and legs and arms and hands made of flesh and bone. And they reach down my throat and into my lungs and force out a scream until they become the creature's own. His voice calls out to me, "Now, Mary, you begin to see." At this point in my book, I wanted to parallel Mary's own book. One of the things that was so innovative about her book was she was the first person to tell her story in the voices of three narratives. Nobody had done that before. Books were always didactic. She gave her creature a voice, she gave Frankenstein a voice, and the explorer Walton a voice. And I wanted to give tribute to that by giving the creature a voice in this book, Mary's Monster. And so this book is at the point where the creature is comes to life, and it's entitled I Am. I am an exiled girl who feels so rejected by her father, she must create a family from ghosts. I am a poet who feels persecuted because society loathes him for his beliefs. I am a sister shackled by illegitimacy and despair, lying down to die alone. I am an abandoned wife standing beside a river, no longer able to endure living. I am the rage and shame that burn like embers through you. I am the words torn from my mind until they pulse like a beating heart. I am your creature. And Mary responds, my creature is me. So 9 months after she began writing and a few short weeks before she gave birth to her third child, Mary finishes the book on a moonlit night, and she describes looking at the manuscript as if peering into the eyes of a new offspring, that of her creature. And it's pretty remarkable to think of this young woman who's literally giving birth to a child and giving birth to a creature that's going to live in our minds for the next 200 years. But given all of that and given her incredible resilience, she is forced to publish the book anonymously. So I wrote this poem. Anonymous, January 1818. Anonymous, I published my book 4 months after my second daughter, Clara, named after her dead sister, is born. Anonymous, because the publisher insists readers will never buy it if they know a woman wrote it. Anonymous, just like my unnamed creature. So I think she felt that sense of not being entitled to her own name. And I think that's the decision why she never gave the creature a name as well. It's remarkable when writing a biography, it's often considered that you shouldn't draw parallels from a person's life in terms of reading their books. And I think that that's true in most cases. But when you have an author this young who is living the life of her novel, I think it's unavoidable. The book was a huge success. It was loathed by reviewers and completely hated, and it created all this controversy, and everybody talked about how scandalous it was, but they loved it. And it was being performed in theaters all over Europe. Mary and Shelley, though, were forced to flee England once again because of Harriet's death. And eventually, Mary went on to lose the children that she had. She did, fortunately, have one child that was born right before Shelley himself drowned. And she went on to keep writing. She wrote several other books. She had to eke out an existence as an anonymous author. But the biggest thing that she did was she ensured that Shelley's poems were published. And so we owe so much to her, not only for Frankenstein, but Shelley went on to be respected as one of the greatest poets of all time. But upon his death, he was completely loathed and scandalized, and it's due to Mary that we have his work as well. So it was really my honor to be able to write this book and spend so many years of my life following this incredibly brilliant and strong woman.
Thank you, Lita.